Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. It is Lent. When we're looking at the church year, we're looking at the seasons of the church year. We're observing Lent now and approaching Holy Week in a few weeks away. And then that season of Easter. The church year really is a beautiful thing. The seasons, the rhythm of the church year, and all that it points us to, all pointing us to Christ and what he has done for us, that we might look at the many aspects of who he is, but all pointing us back to the cross. What do we do with emotions, particularly during these seasons? What are the emotions we might experience? Well, we talk about emotions from time to time and mental health and well-being. And so we have our good friend, Dr. Jack Vyans, to help us sort through those emotions of the seasons of the church year, particularly looking at Lent today. We'll talk with our friend, Dr. Jack Vyans, clinical psychologist, in just a moment. Thanks to our friends at Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family. You can find them in the sponsor section on our website, kfuo.org. Look for Concordia University, Wisconsin. Joining me by phone this morning, Dr. Jack Vyans, clinical psychologist, regular guest here on Faith and Family. Dr. Vyans, welcome back.
Thank you very much, but I think you have the seasons wrong. It looks like Advent here in Illinois. Snow coming down. Yeah, a guy with his sleigh dogs and a sleigh water going down the street, some red-nosed reindeer under it. I think we had the wrong season of the year here.
It was quite a pretty commute this morning. The roads weren't too bad on my commute in. I know it has been for a few people, but the roads were fairly clear on my drive in this morning, but the snow was absolutely beautiful. And we still have a week of winter left before we get into spring. And talking about the seasons of the earth, the environment, but more so the seasons of the church year. You're right; it does feel more like Advent or Christmas. But we probably have more snow during Epiphany, I would imagine. Epiphany and that early part of the year.
Yes, exactly. Less an interesting part of the year for people in their lives and their emotions, their feelings, because all manner of feelings are brought to bear on the Christian during this time of the year. Traditionally, it's a penitential season, and we hear a lot about suffering that Jesus did on the cross for us, the soon-to-be his glorious resurrection. But some people give up things for Lent. You know, some people try to become very somber, very quiet, very, not sorrowful, but during Lent. And then that throws them into a little bit of a tizzy. I see it in my office quite a lot because on one hand, they're looking forward to Easter, but on the other hand, and Palm Sunday and everything, but on the other hand, they're very, sorrowful and feel sometimes very miserable, and they can't quite find, if they get the ashes on Ash Wednesday, there's sort of a lull in the emotions, and they really don't know how to feel, especially for kids in a lot of the Lutheran and Catholic grade schools, et cetera, the private grade schools, they don't know how to, which is the solitary turn on depression. And people can get very depressed during this time of year, not because of snow, but because simply they don't quite know how to adjust themselves.
Well, let's dig into this topic a little bit more. First of all, I have to ask, how in tune are most clinical psychologists with the church year? This is a unique topic probably for you. This isn't would you say this is something that the church year is a common topic among clinical psychologists?
I think that what's happening is that the church year among psychologists may not be what they typically run into. But in my practice, as well as other people that are, let's say, in Christian-oriented psychotherapy are into it, because that's the kind of thing people are talking about, and or people are coming in with general complaints about their lives, that they feel dysregulated, they don't quite feel, you know, as strong as they can, they don't know how to figure themselves out. But so, yes, I would say it's a somewhat unique situation, but it's not really unique when you deal with people that go to we have, in our area here, a huge percentage of our people are either are Christian, either being Lutheran or Catholic or otherwise Baptist. And so it's not too rare for people in this area to hear people talk about that type of thing in their life.
Well, let's start with emotions. Let's establish that. What are emotions, and how are they a part of our lives, particularly the Christian's life. What are emotions and where do they fit into our lives? Are they first article gifts? Are they a result of the fall into sin? What are emotions and how are they a part of our lives?
Well, I'm going to throw you upside down and backwards a little bit. Emotions have always been seen to be something that comes from the brain, that you see a dog, it's a nice pet, you love the dog, you have this emotional love, or your kids, or you feel joyous at church, or you feel sad at a funeral or whatever. But in actual fact, emotions come from the part of the brain that we think through what we see ourselves doing, or we preset ourselves like we've had a disaster in our lives or trauma. So we see something similar to that, like a car accident or something, like you're a loud bang, we just come back from the war, and then our brain says, oh, you should feel this way. Our emotions are really a buffet, that whatever is in our brain is how we will think about it. And that's where the critical variable comes into how to feel during Lent. By the way, one of the great psychologists of all time, his name was Jesus Christ, he said that what's in your heart is how you will behave. What you're having on your mind, how you're orienting yourself, what you believe in, will deliver who you are. For example, in the boat scene when Peter was ready to walk on the water, he was perfectly emotionally very strong because he was interpreting, oh, this is God, he's going to help me. Then all of a sudden he saw the waves, he's like, oh, you're going to be afraid, so he got nervous and sank. So emotions are not some immediate reactive thing that comes about us because we're human. It's an interpretive thing that our brain does for us and pulls us into reality from time to time, and then sometimes takes out of reality. And that's what's critical regarding Lent, because, as you see, Lent doesn't really direct us one way or the other. Many people get sorrowful. Many people are very somber. Many people give up stuff for Lent. But I think I like paradox. And I like to think that Lent should be a time of thankfulness, a time of joy. Because when you're really celebrating for the next 7 weeks, is your salvation. And that because in 7 weeks of what God did, Jesus Christ did, we're saved. And all the other bad things you've ever had in your life, all the other stuff you've been traumatized by, all the other anxiety things, all the other depressive things, are now under his complete control. So, in other words, what you do is you change your mind, and that changes your emotion, you change your mind to be thankful of what God's done for you. And one more thing. This is not without parallel. If you take a look at the Psalms, and I taught a course on the Psalms of our Saviors this past fall during Christmas, you'll notice that most of the Psalms are oriented toward thankfulness and joy. There's a lot of few Psalms in there about how bad the world is and, you know, blah, 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 but and penitence. But most of them, from Psalm 1 to Psalm 150, are, and if you read Psalm 150, it's all based on joy, 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 thankfulness. And I'm suggesting that the listeners, if they take a look at the next 7 weeks, you're celebrating Lent because Jesus Christ did something for you, and so you should be joyful and thankful and celebrative rather than down and dreary.
Now, you mentioned a little bit ago that emotions are a buffet, kind of an outpouring of that which is within us. Let's dig into that a little bit more. Can you explain a little bit more about what you mean by emotions are a buffet and really a reflection of that within us?
Because, quite frankly, we select our emotions. You can wake up in the morning and say, oh, it's Monday morning, it's terrible, it's snowing outside, my flowers are going to die, my kids got to go to school, it's going to be boring at work, same thing all over again. And so, therefore, you can select a monotony, and select sort of a, we call it dysthymic or depressive reaction. Or you could say, hey, it's Monday, it's snowing, I haven't seen snow for a long time, it's fantastic, we're almost towards 60 degrees this weekend, the Cardinals are going to start playing pretty soon, and the Cubs, for that matter, and, the whole world's going to be different. It's a whole 7 days to celebrate life. You just select on the buffet which you want to be. Years ago, there was a movie called Annie Mame, and she said, life is a feast, and some people just don't get to the table, okay? And if you look at the New Testament, constantly, 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 the Lord is talking about bringing you to the big feast, celebration of Christ. All of the topics that Jesus talks to his people is, don't be anxious, fear for nothing. I'll take care of it. When disciples get nervous about the future, he selects the emotion for them. Don't be fearful. I'll take care of it. And what I'm saying is that when you're going through your life's buffet of emotions, select thankfulness and joy, because God in his writings, at least seeing in the Psalms and the New Testament, God does not want you to be worried about anything.
How do emotions affect other aspects of our lives, such as decisions or actions or behaviors?
Well, I tell you what, you want to make a bad decision, then get anxious and nervous and get emotional, because you will not be able to have the strategic thinking ability that you need to think it through. If you have heart disease or even arthritis or any kind of medical condition, the more emotions you select from your buffet, they're always anxious and nervous and down, the less well you'll be, the more likely you'll be at health risk. Because emotions and stress are going to correlate very heavily with how well you do. And I'm suggesting that if you and it's right out of the Bible, the more thankful you are, the more joyous you are, the more at peace you are with yourself and your Creator, and because of His work, not our work, but His work, the more joy we can have in our life and the more healthy we'll be. That's the angle. It's not just some theoretical thing or even some spiritual thing. It's really everyday guidance. Is that if the more healthy you want to be, the better decision maker you want to be, the more you want to talk to your family, the more you focus on joy and thankfulness in your life. For example, I deal with a lot of couples in therapy with issues between families. If you approach life from a real negative, anxious perspective, and you select the emotion of too dreary, you're not going to be very interested in talking to your wife at night, or she with you, or your kids. It's all upside down. But if you look at life joyfully and joyously, and how can I celebrate my life today? Your chance to celebrate with your wife, talk with your kids nicely, and get them to church and have a fun time is overwhelmingly positive.
So the relationship between emotions and the seasons, are seasons impacted by our emotions?
Reverse.
I said that backwards, didn't I? Are emotions affected by seasons?
Yeah, they can be. I mean, the way you were going there, I thought, oh my goodness, somebody in Springfield was thinking real bad thoughts with that snow this morning. But the fact is, there is solid evidence that the darkness that occurs during certain seasons of the year can make people more or less depressive. That's why, or they can select that depressive viewpoint because it's dark outside and dark in the evening, quicker, et cetera. But that's why you can take actions against that. There's these lights you can buy, they're very cheap. There are full season lights you can read your newspaper under and convince there's a gland in your brain called the pineal gland that needs light. And it convinces your pineal gland that it's a daylight time rather than twilight time. So in actual fact, yes, seasons do affect that. And that's why I'm saying it's sort of interesting that Lent comes usually during that season of the year where it's so darker outside. So therefore, it can cause you to feel, let's say, if you will, a little more down. But on the other hand, Christmas also is during a dark time of the year. In fact, one of the shortest days of the year. I don't know too many kids or grandkids that I know that aren't happy when Christmas shows up. So again, you can select the emotion you want for the day.
So there are environmental factors that can affect emotions. As you mentioned, the shortness of daylight during these seasons certainly can impact emotions. Other common factors, whether they're environmental or biological, that can significantly affect emotions?
Yes, if you've had a history of past traumas, especially during these times of year, like a loss of someone, and I hear that a lot during this time of year because a lot of our parents or grandparents or brothers or sisters died or passed away during this time, or relationships broke up during this time, or jobs were there and then not there at this time, they were fired or whatever, those past histories can really affect your emotions, because quite frankly, you will remember the past history a lot, the past trauma, and it's almost like living the trauma now. And what I'm suggesting to people is if they are facing a trauma this time of year or an emotion that they've selected in the past, basically means they bring back anxiety or depression, take a good look in your Bible. Nowadays, you can do it on Google Psalms or Google verses that focus about thankfulness and praise and joy and assurance in Christ, and read those, focus on the Word. A lot of my people I see, we talk about things a lot, but their homework is they're sent home with Bible passages to read and focusing on things that are where God in history has helped his people and he always continues to help them. And if they see that, even though they've had a trauma, lost a parent, lost a son, lost whatever, a relationship, whatever, lost a job, they can see, as bad as it is in the earthly realm, in the spiritual realm, in the historical realm, and I call it historical because historical is how God acts. In the historical realm, God always is there to save them.
So you propose that thankfulness is the emotion of Lent. Let's dig a little bit deeper. Why during Lent is thankfulness the emotion?
Because I think Lent has an exact aim. As you said, it's 7 weeks or now five, something like that. It's Easter. Now, who's not going to be thankful at Easter time? Okay, seriously. I mean, it is the penultimate time of the Christian calendar or life in general. You are saved. It's done. Philosophy, Christ said on the cross, it is finished. The bill is paid. No more Visa bills. No more MasterCard bills. No more American Express from Satan. It is paid. It is finished. And I think that's a very good emotion to have. He throws his example. We don't read the Bible sometimes. We read the Bible, but we don't read the Bible. I always point people to Luke 24. Read Luke 24. What happens in Luke 24? Yes, it's a statement that Jesus Christ is resurrected from the grave. But what is the human dimension on Luke 24? Take a look at that tonight. Luke 24 is two sullen, morose, depressed, anxious guys walking to Emmaus. And they actually chide this guy, his name is Jesus, chide him for not knowing what's going on. He hasn't read the Wall Street Journal, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that day. Don't you realize what happened in Jerusalem last week? This guy that was full of promises, full of everything, died. He's gone. Our whole career is gone. The world's in shatters. There's trauma. You know, they almost need medical attention, these guys. And, you know, and what's happening? In Luke 24, Jesus Christ is walking with them every step of the way. So the very person they think is dead is walking with them. And then all of a sudden he starts giving them the Bible passages, the same thing I talk about in therapy, the uplifting cross, to give them the history to let them know what's going on. And then they finally realize who it is. That's what I guess I'm saying is the paradoxical interpretation of Lent. That what you should do is take that Luke 24 walk with the Savior, where you are saying, okay, I'm down, I'm despondent, it's Lent, I'm tearful, I'm anxious, I'm nervous. But then you take that walk with Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ then lets you know all the promises, all the future, and what's really going on in your life. Now, really, everything's pretty wonderful. And that it's wonderful not because you feel good, but it's wonderful because he's there walking with you. And he never, ever lets you go. If you take two central passages in the scriptures, one is Luke 24, the other is Romans 8, it's all laid out for you everywhere. And, of course, if Romans 4 doesn't hurt either. It's all there. That he's declared you righteous, and if you're declared righteous by him and everything else is finished, then it is telosate. Be happy, be thankful, because somebody paid your bill, and it was a huge bill.
No, what you're describing is much of what we see in Holy Week and at Easter. What about this time prior to that during Lent?
Get prepared. That's what I'm saying, is that if you're going to prepare for this Holy Week, okay, which you're going to get to pretty soon, like 4 weeks or something like from now, let alone a little more, then what should we focus on? Prepare for your salvation. Prepare the way of the Lord. Be cognizant of the fact that what's going to be going on in Holy Week is all for you. Be cognizant of the fact that let's go back to basics. God did not have to do this. He could have ended this whole thing in Genesis 1. He created the world. He separated him from sin. And he could have ended it, started all over somewhere. He chose from even before the world to do this thing. So if God took his time to choose to save you and put this whole thing in readiness, then why not be joyous all the time? Take a look at Psalm 150. That's years, years before Holy Week. What did David say in Psalm 150? Is he talking about being somber or sober? He's talking about, let's be happy because we are saved. If you look at a lot of those passages in the Old Testament, they talk about being happy. Isaiah says, comfort, comfort my people. Comfort, comfort my people. That means he wants you to realize Emmanuel's on his way. The approach is here. Be happy during the approach.
So let's look at some of the other seasons of the church year. Thankfulness is associated with Lent. What about other seasons of the church year? You pointed out we have Holy Week and Easter coming up, and then Pentecost, which is this long season of the church year, and then we eventually return back to the beginning of the church year with Advent and Christmas, Advent also being a penitential season. Are there emotions that you associate with other seasons of the church year?
You brought up Pentecost, right?
Yes, sir.
What caused Pentecost to happen? Tell me what happened in the Pentecost, you had the disciples up there who were being rather thankful for what happened to them, and they started sharing their thankfulness with others, right? They found other people in the church. So if once you get thankful on your own through Lent and through Holy Week, then when Pentecost happens, which is very soon thereafter, share it with other people. Because if you go to work in a thankful spirit, and you go to work in a celebrative spirit, and you go to work in a happy spirit, they're going to say, what's wrong with you? You should be down. This is basic, monotonous work. And you'll say, I'm thankful because of what God did for me in my life. I'm going to show my thankfulness to you, and I'll share it with you. And when you share your thankfulness with each other, then you get that strange word falling in there called koinonia, which is fellowship. You can bring other people in. Pentecost was people at the beginning of the time of the year where you shared the spirit, shared the thankfulness with others. And what I'm suggesting is if this is a thankful time during Lent, then you share it during Pentecost with other people. Because quite frankly, if you want to talk about the weather again, it's getting warmer. You can take walks around your block. You can invite people over barbecues, whatever you do. Go to Cardinal games. But talk about how thankful you are for what God did for you and share it.
So what I'm hearing you say is thankfulness is really not just associated with Lent, but all of the church year.
That's correct. But it becomes, if you want to look at it this way, I guess, during Lent would be personal thankfulness, where it's internal to you, and you're talking about how it affected you, etc. Then when you get to Pentecost, it becomes a community sharing of thankfulness with others. Because that's what Pentecost is all about. In fact, if you take a look at Peter and Paul, John, especially Paul, from Pentecost forward, it was all about the other people sharing, talking. Kind of in trouble sometimes, but sharing, and talking about the thankfulness that they had in God, and that's what you brought people in. So one is internal. Let's say you're going to be thankful at Lent internally, then you get externally thankful when it comes up in the Pentecost season.
So during the season of Lent, it's more of a personal, reflective type of thankfulness that I hear you saying, and then during Easter and Pentecost, more of an outward or external thankfulness that's a joy that's shared with others.
Yes, because you see what the interesting thing is Lent has always been sort of a, if you will, an internal reflection, and sometimes it's been done to reflect upon your sins, your sinful life, and be sorry for what you did, which is fine. But I'm suggesting what you do is the next step, which is you say, I'm also thankful for God, what he's done for me during this time with Easter coming on, the crucifixion of Easter coming on. And that's the angle to do it internally. Then when you get done with Easter, you jump out to the world and say, look what God did for me. Look how I've been, poor, miserable sinner. And now I've been saved by his righteousness, and I want to share that with you. Effectively, you never leave the dynamic of thankfulness. You never leave that dynamic. But what you do leave behind is that shroud of fear, the shroud of anxiety, the shroud of depression, and you burn that shroud up by the joy of Jesus.
So this thankfulness is a year-round thing. How we approach it, whether it be a personal or sharing it more externally with others, but yet it's something that... you think is beneficial to us as it helps shape how we go about things. As going back to this discussion about emotions that began earlier, we talked about it being a buffet and of emotions and feelings that will really shape other aspects of our lives. So if we start with thankfulness, then the other aspects of our lives merely reflect that thankfulness.
That is correct, and quite frankly, if you take a look at the Bible, this is not just psychology, buddy. This is in the Bible. All over the Bible, God is talking about being thankful. He wants that kind of reaction. That's because he knows that's healthy for us, and quite frankly, it's reality. He did all this so we can be happy and be thankful to him. If you read the description of heaven, which is in Revelation, other places, those people up there are pretty happy, pretty thankful. And I'm just suggesting that a pre-heaven thankfulness now, selected as an emotion.
Dr. Jack Fiennes, clinical psychologist, thank you so much for being my guest today. Again, Dr. Fiennes, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Just let me know when the podcast is up. I love it.
Very good. God's blessings. Coming up in just a little bit, how safe is your home computer? How about your personal information that's saved, that's digital information, and where you keep it? How safe is that? How secure is that? Are you at risk? We have a professional to help us sort through those questions. Up next on Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
Barbara Bush, the daughter of President George W. Bush, was a recent keynote speaker for a ritzy Planned Parenthood fundraising luncheon. This is the same abortion mill caught on video salvaging intact brains for resale from late-term abortions. Ms. Bush said she was proud to stand with Planned Parenthood. She called the abortion giant a one-stop shop for everything related to women's health and all their social problems. Tragically, abortion generates more problems than it claims to solve. Millions of mothers and fathers of aborted children have been deeply scarred emotionally. Countless women have been physically maimed. Undoubtedly, Barbara Bush deeply cares about the welfare of women. If she had done her homework, she'd realize Planned Parenthood doesn't share this passion.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Join Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service and congregations across the country as we celebrate Refugee Sunday, a time to lift up the gifts that migrants and refugees bring to our country and to reflect on Christ's message to welcome the stranger. Together, we can continue the mission of welcoming, embracing, and empowering newcomers. Visit LIRS.org/kit to download the Refugee Sunday kit for your congregations, including worship guides, bulletin inserts, videos, and more. LIRS.org/kit.
I'm Kip Allen, host of Let's Talk, The Pastor Is In. Friday's guest is William Swerla, senior pastor of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California. Pastor Swerla and I are going to have a casual chat, and we'd love to have you join us. Call us at 314-821-0850 in the St. Louis area, or 800-730-2727 anywhere in North America. Let's Talk, Friday at 2 p.m. Central Time on Worldwide KFUO.
Dear John, I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is serious, and I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to when you checked on me? I don't want to leave, but remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range today. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
The NLS Braille and Talking Book Program gives patrons with visual or physical disabilities the freedom to read their way.
If you want to read in electronic Braille, you can. If you want to read on your phone, you can. If you want to read in hard print, you can.
Everybody can read the way they want to read using this program.
For more information about the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped Library of Congress, visit loc.gov/thatallmayread.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Is your home computer safe? What information do you store on your home computer or in other digital spaces? How safe is that information? We hear stories in the news all the time of information and security of that information being at risk. I know I have questions. Perhaps you do as well. To help us with those questions today, we have Dave Farquhar. He's Technical Account Manager with Qualys. Dave, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you for inviting me to come on, Andy.
It's a joy to have you here today.
Yeah, I've been an IT professional for about 20 years, and I specialize in a field of security called vulnerability management, and that's the technical term for what we'll be talking about today. I've done that, done vulnerability management on government contracts, military contracts, and also for a Fortune 20 company. And today I'm working for Qualys. They are a security company based out of California. We do vulnerability management for about 9,200 customers worldwide, including most of the Forbes Global 100 and the Fortune 100. So I manage 30 accounts for Qualys, all in the Midwest, and they're all large companies with more than 5,000 employees. And I'm really glad to be here today because security professionals like me talk about this stuff all the time amongst ourselves, but we're not doing any good talking amongst ourselves. We really need to be talking to people like you and your audience.
And security is obviously very important to businesses when it comes to their information systems and their online presence, anywhere that information is stored or kept. Security is important to businesses.
Yes.
As individuals with a personal computer or even personal devices, we don't always think about that. I mean, sometimes we do, but we don't really know enough about it to think, okay, what's my next step? What should I be doing?
Exactly. And I think that a lot of times we have the wrong kind of fear of computers. There's the fear as in I'm afraid of it. And there's the fear that is a healthy respect, like what we talk about in confirmation class. I remember Pastor writing on the chalkboard, when it comes to fearing God, fear is to have respect for.
Mm-hmm.
We did not have adequate respect for our computers and the damage that they can cause to us and to others. Frequently, when your computer gets hacked, it's not you who's the victim. It's somebody else who's the victim. So when Jesus talked about loving our neighbor, taking care of our computer is part of loving our neighbor.
Sure. The information that's stored on our computer not only affects us, great point, it affects others as well.
Yes.
When we share, when we have someone else's information on there, it may be harming someone else.
Yes.
So I know that we have a lot to dig into today. I read the notes that you shared with me beforehand. There's a lot to dig into. And for our listeners who are more visual, we're going to share some notes with them later as well, give them access to some of these resources as well online. So let's get to the first big question. How can I know how secure my home computer is? A lot of us have a laptop or a desktop, some perhaps even multiple computers at home. We probably have, tablets and mobile devices as well, which I know is a whole different game in some aspects. But let's just talk about that typical home computer, maybe where we do a number of things. We might do shopping. We might manage our bills, the electric bill and our other utilities on there, and maybe some banking, things like that. Maybe kids are doing homework on there as well, and maybe some entertainment. The typical home computer, it's the multi-purpose machine.
It is. So there are several things that you need to do in order to know. Now, the good news is there's a very good chance that your home computer could be more secure than your computer at work if you're doing the right things. So this is a conversation I have all the time where, well, my home computer is fine. Why are all their computers at work a mess? How do we get our Qualys scores down to something acceptable? It's explaining to people that, hey, it's harder to manage 10,000 computers than one or 12 home computers at home. Some of us have that many. hopefully not too many people in the audience. But so the first question is, are you running a supported operating system? So if you have a PC, if you're running Windows 7, Windows 8.1, or Windows 10, you're okay. Windows 7 will be supported, getting security updates for another 2.5 years or so. Windows 10 will be supported for another 8.5 years. So if you have a Windows 7 computer, you've got a couple of years to get upgraded to Windows 10. But if you're running Windows 10 now, chances are Windows 10 will still be getting support long after you're not using that computer anymore.
And Windows 8.1 is kind of in between.
It's in between. Frankly, you'll be happier with Windows 10 than you would be with 8.1. That was why they rushed Windows 10 out. So
my computer automatically upgraded to Windows 10.
Yes, that was a whole other controversy. We probably don't have time to get into that here, but in some ways that was a good thing, but it caught a lot of people by surprise.
Absolutely, absolutely. But that brings us to automatic updates.
Yes. Can we talk about Macintoshes before we talk about automatic updates? So on Macs, situation's a little bit different. Apple releases the operating systems much faster than Microsoft does, but still the rule is three. With Microsoft, it varies as to how many. But with Apple, if you are running Sierra, El Capitan, or Yosemite on your Mac, you're okay. Now, Apple releases a new operating system every 12 to 15 months, historically, at least going back to 2011. So we can assume that that pattern will continue. Sierra just came out, so we can expect that there will be a new Mac OS in about a year or so. At that point in time, if you're still on Yosemite, you've got a problem.
So you always want to be on top of whatever you want to be aware of what the current operating system is and the time frame on the one that you have,
yes,
that you currently have, if you don't have the newest one.
Yes.
Because that, what happens if you're not on top of that? If you don't have the current or the second most current?
So when it falls out of support, you don't get those security updates anymore. So if you have a Windows XP computer at home, if you have a version of Mac OS that's named after a cat, those aren't getting those upgrades. They haven't gotten those upgrades for several years. Now, sometimes there's a piece of software that we need that doesn't run on a newer system. That's okay. Just don't go online. Don't fire up your web browser and don't check your email on that computer anymore. But I have plenty of things that only run on an older system. So I have one older system that I use for those things, and that's all that I use it for.
So we're talking about if you have some specific application, some legacy software that's not going to work with newer versions of newer operating systems, you can keep that computer, keep that system, but don't do online activity
exactly
on that. Keep that strictly for that application. It's time to look at upgrading, getting a newer system that can handle the newer operating system.
Yes. And if you can't afford to go and buy a new $500 computer or a new $1,000 computer, go to an independent computer store or something along the lines of ECP Computers in Overland. They will sell you a refurbished, usually business class computers, so they're good, reliable machines, about $150, and it'll have a new copy of Windows on it. And so that will be good for several years, and that is actually a higher quality computer than that $400 office supply store special. So,
handy little tip there.
Yes, very much so. That is actually what I have, like my family members who live somewhere outside of St. Louis, that's actually what I recommend that they buy.
Especially if you are a multi-computer household, you've got kids on computers for homework purposes.
Yes.
Trying to find an affordable way to have everybody on a computer, I'm sure, is important.
My kids have $100 ThinkPads, but they're ThinkPads. They're good machines. Mm-hmm. They're just several years old, but they're running Windows 10, and they're secure.
And they meet all the needs that everyone
has. Yeah, my first grader has a nicer computer than I have right now.
Now, having a machine that someone else has used before, does that create some questions regarding security?
No big deal, because when they refurbish it, part of the process of being a Microsoft authorized refurbisher is they wipe the hard drive and they put a fresh operating system on it.
So there's no chance of someone else getting access to your information.
As long as you're getting your automatic updates.
As long as you're doing your updates.
So let's talk about that.
Okay.
So your automatic updates. If you're running Windows 10, it is nearly impossible to disable those automatic updates. So you're good. If you're running Windows 7, it's very difficult to disable automatic updates. You know if you did it. So if you know that you disabled those, go back and re-enable them. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you're good. On Macintoshes, there is an option. If you go and you fire up the App Store and go into the system preferences, there are three options that I want you to look at. So one of them is a checkbox to install security updates. I want you to check that box. There's another box for updating your the operating system itself. I can go either way on that one. If you want to be cutting edge, be one of the first people on the new operating system, sure, go ahead and check that box. If you want to wait and see and how other people are doing with it, leave that box unchecked. There's a third box in there to update the applications that you download from the App Store. I recommend that you check that box as well. So if you update or check those two boxes, your Mac is very secure.
So if you... What if you have this philosophy of not being an early adopter?
Sure.
And you want to always, anytime new, either new operating system comes out or application updates as well, you want to wait a little bit and see if they work out the bugs first.
Sure. So when it comes to the operating system itself, I tend to wait about a year. So I installed Windows 10 after it had been out for about a year. I did have it running on one machine out of curiosity, but not one that I used on a regular basis. And for Mac users, you can do the same thing very safely. For applications, I actually do recommend that you do the updates, the reason being that the reason the update exists in the first place is because of bugs. So, do you want the bugs that the bad guys know about? Do you want the bugs that the bad guys don't know about yet? I want the bugs that the bad guys don't know about.
Well, let's can we talk about the bad guys? And
sure.
What it is that they're going after, or am I jumping ahead too far?
We're jumping ahead a little bit.
We'll come to that then in a little bit.
Yeah, let me talk about applications for just one more minute, and then we'll talk about the bad guys. So there are some applications that exist outside of the App Store. So we've got two tools that will help you with that. First thing, I'm going to plug my employer. So Qualys has a product called Qualys Browser Check. It's free. It's an extension that loads into your web browser, and it tells you if your web browser is updating successfully and if your plugins like Adobe Flash and Adobe Reader that hook into your web browser are updating properly. If they are not, then it gives you a visual warning that something is wrong so you can go do something before something bad happens. Now, what about your Office suites and that other software that may exist outside of the App Store? There's another vendor, Flexera Software. They have a free home use product. You can only use that product at home. They have a business class product that they want you to buy for business, and this kind of advertises it. But what it will do is go and update everything that either doesn't auto-update on its own or fails to auto-update. And if it finds something that it can't update for some reason, then it gives you a pop-up and says, hey, I can't update this. Click here, gives you a link to download the update, and then you can run it. Then you know that that software is up to date. And I know that you won't do this on your own, because when it was my job to keep up with all this stuff, I had a huge whiteboard, and I still couldn't keep track of all of it.
Wow.
So having a piece of software that keeps track of that for you definitely helps.
So keeping your software up to date, whether it's applications or the operating system, keeping that up to date is going to make a difference in how secure your computer is.
Exactly. And I'll tell you why. Let's talk about the bad guys. So
yeah, how easily can somebody get into my information, get into my home computer?
If those updates aren't happening, it is far, far too easy. And this is going to scare you, and it should scare you. First, let me talk about what a hack actually looks like, because I don't think most of my colleagues do a real good job of explaining this sometimes. So normally, programs are programs, and data is data. So you'll have like Microsoft Word sitting over here, and you have a document that you load into Microsoft Word. Now, what if I can take a program that gives me access to your computer and hide that in that Word document? You load that document into Microsoft Word, my program runs up against a bug in Microsoft Word that tricks Word into launching that program. So Word crashes, or it may only partially crash, partially misbehave. You don't really know what's going on. But in the meantime, this malicious program has run, and now the bad guy is on your computer. So that's what it looks like. So if I, and the scenario I'm going to describe now, this is purely hypothetical. I would never do this to anybody. It would be the end of my career. I'd never work in this town again or this industry again. But I have to be able to explain this. So if I have it out for you, Andy, here's how I would go about getting onto your computer. So I would have to come up with my hack. That would take me about an hour to do. So not a big deal. Now, if I email this to you and you get this email from this Dave guy that you just met asking you to open this document, you're probably not going to do it. At least I hope not. So, and don't open email attachments from strangers, please. I think that that's something everybody knows, but if you're not sure, don't open email attachments from strangers. So, if I'm going to be a good, effective bad guy, what I need to do is find somebody you know. And if I really have it out for you, I can probably find somebody that we both know, because if I have it out for you, there's a reason. So I went on Facebook and I punched your name in and I found two people we know that we both know. And one of them, I came up with a pretty good scenario right away. I know he's in seminary. So if he's in seminary, he's probably writing sermons from time to time as part of his class. So, well, if he were to email you and say, hey, Andy, I've got this sermon that I wrote, and I'd really like your thoughts on it, you probably would open that email. You probably would open it and expect to need to respond to it. And you'd probably do it fairly quickly. So I would then go and register a Gmail account or a Hotmail account under his name, write up that story that I just told you, attach that file. Now I need to send it to you, except I don't have your email address. That's the hardest part, is getting your email address. I could probably go and find it without you knowing about it. Might take me a week or so. Or I could just ask Alex. Alex might give it to me. If I have some random person call the studio and ask you for your personal email address, you might give it to them. The answer is always no if I don't ask.
I'm not reading any sermons from Alex. I figured it out.
So when you...
You did your homework.
And it took all of 30 seconds to find his name and about 2 minutes for me to think of that scenario. So it is extremely easy. Now, that's not normally how these things go down. So because it takes a little bit of time to, once you're on your computer, and in this scenario, basically what would happen is you would open that, attachment, and I would have a command prompt on your computer. I could list all of your files, pull down anything that looks interesting, and you would never know. But finding what the most valuable file is in there would be difficult. And then I've got to find somebody to sell it to. It's a whole lot more effective for me to sell your data back to you. So
can you unpack that a little bit?
Yes.
What do you mean? Sell it back to me. So, it's my information.
Yes. So the way these typically go down now is that you get a notice that all of your files on your computer have been encrypted with a password, and you need to pay me $250 in digital currency, untraceable, of course, to get a password to get your files back. And you'll probably have a deadline of maybe 2 weeks, maybe 30 days to go and do that. And as the deadline approaches, the price may go up to incentivize you to pay the ransom early.
Now, are these typically appearing as a ransom? Are they like using a pretend brand name, like it's some sort of protection software for your computer, and that your information has been secured somewhere else because we've protected your information somewhere else? Is it that type of scenario, or does it really appear like we're holding your information hostage?
It is more like we are holding your information hostage. So when you see it, you get a message on your computer that states that here's...
we're hackers and we stole your information.
Yes. It is that blatant. And frequently, there is a support number to call. Now, when you call that support number, that is to help you get that digital currency. So they actually have a support line to help you get that digital digital currency, because you wouldn't know how to go and buy Bitcoins to go and pay for this. If they say then there's fake ransomware as well. And when that happens, they will call when you call them, they will offer to assist you in cleaning your computer. Those are scams. When that happens, just restart your computer, run a virus scan. It will scan clean. I can almost guarantee that. If the message pops up again that your files are encrypted and we want Bitcoins, then that's a pretty good indication that you have actual ransomware.
So what do you do in that scenario?
Unfortunately, what you have to do is either pay the ransom, or hopefully you have backup copies and can restore your backups. I would much rather you restore backups than give $250 to a criminal.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we only have just a few minutes left, about 3.5-4 minutes left here. How do I avoid that? How do I make sure that I'm keeping my information safe? What can I do to improve the security?
Okay, so flying through this. First thing is, let's talk about passwords for a minute. Get yourself a password manager. Stop using Bible verses as passwords. They make lousy passwords for any number of reasons that we don't have time to get into, but the biggest problem is we only use about 20 or 30 of them. And when it comes to passwords themselves, we use a very limited number of the billions of passwords that are possible. So get a password manager. LastPass, 1Password, and KeePass are three that I recommend.
What do those do?
They will set random passwords for you and store them for you. So you sign in and it will issue those, or it will enter those passwords for you when you sign into Facebook at that point. So when you have that or any other website that's important to you. So when you do that, these passwords typically have will be good for decades as opposed to like a year. So there is no reason to change your passwords after you do this. So you won't have to worry about coming up with new passwords after this. Password changing is obsolete.
Tell me about it.
So the next thing that I would like for you to do is, if you have specific documents on your computer that have sensitive information in them, load them up. Go and do the save as. Make sure you're saving them in something newer than Office 2003 format. So change that to a new modern file format, then check the box that says secure this document with a password. That is very secure. That is military-grade encryption. So save that file, delete the original unencrypted one. Those files are now safe. Lastly, make backup copies. So if you have a fair bit of money to spend, there's a service called Carbonite that will go and automatically back you up into the cloud. And their most expensive option even has a courier service if you need it. If you don't want to spend that kind of money, here's the cheap option. Get yourself some cloud storage, something like Box or OneDrive or Google Drive. Copy your documents folder onto that. Then copy them onto an external hard drive. Unplug that external hard drive, store it in your basement. Then copy them onto some USB thumb drives. Do the same thing. Store one of those in your basement. Ideally, find a friend who lives somewhere outside of where you live and have them store yours and do them the favor and store theirs for them.
So we're talking about documents that have a lot of sensitive and important information. These are like long-term documents
and anything that's important to you. So The idea being, if you were to get ransomware, if your laptop got stolen, if it just conks out and the computer store says there's nothing we can do, you know, the hard drive is dead. You've replaced the hard drive, reinstall the operating system, restore your backup, and you can start over again.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking there are some documents that you're going to be accessing more frequently than, you know, what you would on a jump drive or a thumb drive that you're sending to a friend somewhere.
Sure. So if the document isn't terribly sensitive, doesn't have your social security number in it, I wouldn't bother with the encryption.
Gotcha.
If you've got a document that has your social security number, your insurance policies and all that, absolutely encrypt that document.
All very helpful tips today. If I know that there is plenty more, we could probably go on for a couple hours in terms of being easily safe. So we're going to share some links to these tips that you've shared with us today. You've put them on a blog, so we'll share a link to that with the archive of today's program on our website as well, kfuo.org. Dave Farquhar, thanks so much for being my guest today, technical account manager with Qualys. It's very insightful. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Andy.
Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word, right here on Worldwide KFUO.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.